Good afternoon, this is Gary Kavanagh. I'm here today with my friend and colleague, Michael Dwyer. Michael, how have you been since we last spoke last week?
I've been tolerably well, Gary. And yourself?
I've been pretty good. It's been a bit of a whirlwind on the old immigration front. I mean, at the start of the week, I thought, we'll talk about McEntee's performance when she went against Michael McNamara. And he systematically disassembled her to such an extent that I actually kind of felt bad for her. But then as the week went on, a story was picked up from the committee, but it wasn't really the story I thought it would be.
Yeah.
It was a story based on something that McEntee had said in the committee in the midst of, you know, getting kicked around a bit, where she had said that she would estimate that 80% or so of asylum applicants are now coming from the UK via Northern Ireland.
Sorry, just to get that clear, because that number appears. 80% of applicants were now coming via the North of Ireland.
So says McEntee. Now, I was a bit surprised to see this as the main story, because I had seen that she had said this. The problem I had, and I'll put a link to this so that people can go through it, is that she doesn't very effectively explain what she's basing that on. We've known for a long time that a lot of people are coming into the country and they're first making the asylum application, not at airports or anything like that, but actually at one of the international...
One of the offices in Dublin somewhere.
Yeah, and that number has gone up or down, but it's always been a very considerable mix of it. What I think is being said here, what I think is happening, is that 80% of people are now basically turning up at one of the centres, not at a border. And that's fine. What I'm unclear on is what evidence they have that these people came from the UK. And in the committee, she doesn't really explain what's happening here. So there's a question of, are these people who tell you they came from the UK? In which case, how do you verify that? Or is it a case that these are people who turn up in the country and say, you know, there's no record of them at ports or at any of the airports. And so you assume they've come over the border.
So how, I mean, okay, allowing that maybe X number of them volunteer the information that they had previously been in the UK, there would be a record in the UK if they had already applied for international protection there, wouldn't there?
There would be, but it's not clear if they had applied for international protection there and in what percentages. The minister, when asked about this, doesn't seem to have a lot of the figures on hand, as I said, nor does she really explain how that figure has been gotten at, because it's difficult to figure out in terms of asylum flows or in terms of illegal migration where people have come from. So I'm curious to know what the actual, what documentation there is, what are they relying on, what are people saying?
Yeah.
And some of them may have claimed asylum in the UK. But I think, Michael, rather than saying I think there's anything potentially misleading about this figure, I think it is very politically useful for the government to be able to point at something and go, that's not our fault. And also, the only way to deal with it is something that no one wants to do, which would be to check people on the border. And obviously we couldn't do that, Michael. So, you know, what can you expect? Now, there's word out that, it's probably in the papers now already, that Simon Harris is making noise about emergency legislation to deal with our inability to get people back to the UK because of the UK's Rwanda policy, even though that's still back in a bit of a back and forth. We've had Rishi Sunak come out and say that the comments that have been made by Helen McEntee and now Micheál Martin indicate that the Rwandan policy is working and is doing what they wanted it to do, which is to cut down on the amount of asylum seekers coming to Britain. My only thought there is that this is kind of a very politically useful situation for both the Irish government and Rishi Sunak, because both are having real troubles with immigration. They're both having popular discontent about it, and being able to, on one hand, go, that's not our fault, but we're going to do something. We're going to bring in emergency legislation, but it, you know, our failures are understandable. And on the other hand, we are doing something that's cutting down illegal immigration. It's kind of positive for everyone. The other thing that she mentions, and I haven't seen in much of the reporting about this, is she says that this has only been true the last few months. That this is not a long-term situation. Which I suppose then, Michael, begs the question, well, how long is it? Because I've gone back through the January figures on where people turned up. And IPO arrivals were a large percentage of it, but they were not the majority. And they were certainly not 80% over the month of January. So we're talking February, March, maybe April. I haven't been able to get those statistics yet. But there's no detail here. There's nothing here to actually be able to tell how accurate are these figures, can they stand up, or is this a case where there is, to an extent, a legitimate problem, and to an extent, an opportunity for the government?
Well, it's a very useful problem, isn't it? First of all, if they're coming over the border, there is, on the face of it, very little we can do about that, because unless we can come up with some kind of incredibly creative thing, because we have the free travel area, the common travel area, rather, between the Republic and the United Kingdom. And especially as regards the border between the North and the South, there will be a very, very deep and understandable political reluctance to make that look like anything except an open border that people can easily travel to and fro from. Secondly, for Rishi Sunak and for Helen and for Simon, obviously it's a win-win. Rishi Sunak wants to show that in the face of a lot of opposition from non-governmental organisations, advocacy groups in the United Kingdom, and from his opposition, some members of the opposition parties, the Rwandan policy, which had been a hissing in a byword, look, it's actually working. People are now being disincentivized from staying and applying in the UK, and they're going to Ireland because it is working. They are now, that there's a, rather than a pull factor, this has created a push factor. For the Irish government, well, the Rwandan policy is pushing people over here, but also, am I misremembering, but doesn't it create a legal problem for us because it's much more difficult for us to deport people back to Britain because of the Rwandan policy?
Well, that is the case following the High Court judgment. And when Helen McEntee was in the committee, she did mention that, and that she was going to have a bill in the coming weeks that will address that. That, I think, has led to what we've seen with Harris saying, you know, there's going to be an emergency bill to deal with this so that we can start putting people back to the UK. So we have a problem that has been quite a long time coming, which is now being pointed at, well, this is the cause of that problem and we will have an immediate solution, but absolutely no evidentiary backing as to what's there. When McEntee was asked, who are these people? You know, what's the mix of people? Do they come from the UK? Were they in other European countries first? Are they students? How are they getting in? It was just, I don't have that figure. We're gathering that figure, but I don't have it with me. And also, she had to clarify a bit late into it that she didn't mean that it was the case last year. Because if the case last year, you know, 13,000 people would have come from the UK. And that was how it was originally taken by the senators, because largely of the way she phrased it, she did not make clear initially, you know, I'm only talking about the last few months, by which it appears to be the last 2 months. So,
yeah, do you also wonder, Gary, and this obviously sitting here, this pure speculation, the idea that they can just come up with a bill in a couple of weeks that's going to solve the problem of returning people because of the Rwanda, because if the problem of returning people was a concern about their safety because of the risk that they might then be deported or held in Rwanda, that I'm not sure can be on the face of it solved by some simple piece of three or four lines of legislation. Because the issue of their safety, that will be based on a number of treaty obligations that we have, and how the court understands those obligations that we have that if we are returning people, that we can only return them to a safe place. And I don't know. I mean, I'm very obviously not a lawyer, but when I heard that, I thought, geez, is it going to be as easy as that to satisfy the courts? Who, if they have a problem with them being sent back to the UK because of Rwanda, as long as the Rwanda thing is, I don't know. We'll see. Maybe they can do it, but I'm sceptical.
There is a cynical possibility here, Michael, that Simon Harris, in a rare moment for an Irish politician, has realised that you actually don't need to be able to get by the courts. You just need to do something that makes it look like you're trying to get by the courts and then allow the courts to stop you.
Okay, yeah, that's reasonable.
Strangely rare understanding in Ireland that sometimes, you know, if you try and do something and the courts stop you, people might actually, you know, support you or like you more because it seems like you're trying to do something.
Maybe, and maybe you'll get credit from enough people for it to be politically useful. I just have the feeling, Gary, that it would have been more useful to do that kind of thing a couple of years ago. That if I was going to be starting to do that kind of stuff, I wouldn't have started now. I think there's a population out there that's looking for something a little bit more in the red meat line when it comes to this problem. And go and say, well, we did our best, lads, but, you know, the court stopped us.
We have two polls out that are quite interesting. One is the standard political poll, and one is a more social poll coming from the Irish Times, Ipsos, BNA, the Signs of the Time, Signs of the Time survey, they call it. Basically, they just ask a load of questions to try and gauge people's concerns and their general feelings. For those who have not ever gone through one of these surveys, I would make the general point that you should probably just ignore all of the written text because it's not good. Like the statistical information is valuable, but some of their explanations of what are actually happening, not just this year, but frequently, are just nonsense. Like, you know, clearly they're in a situation where we have the figures, we have to say something, and we have to make it seem like we know what we're talking about. But you just end up with this waxing poetic about something that you can't know from the surveys you have. But whatever, the actual statistical work is good. There's some interesting stuff in it. I think the first thing to note here is that independents are up. Sinn Féin is up. Fine Gael is up. One, but still up. And Fianna Fáil is down two. Now, Michael, this brings Fianna Fáil to the glorious realm of 14%.
14%. I quite liked the rather gentle way the Business Post observed that this was a two-year low, which makes it feel rather, yeah, well, it's only a two-year low. You know, it's been worse. I don't know if it's ever been a much worse. And going back, as we have before, to point out that in 2011, in the year of the great disaster, they got 17.5% of the vote and came home with 20 TDs. And as regards the upcoming election, what is going to be really concerned, and this is something we have been talking about a little bit for a while, there has been a lot of concern in the media and within Fine Gael that Fine Gael is facing into a very bad election. Very bad locals, it's going to be bad locals, it's going to be bad Europeans, and Fine Gael is in trouble. They've had Leo going, Simon coming in, all of this chassis, and a lot of discussion about the fact that they have lost so many of their incumbent TDs, which is a problem. And it is a problem, that is true. But as we have been pointing out, they are still 5-6 points ahead of Fianna Fáil at a national level. And no matter what happens locally, if you have a national result where you have that kind of gap, that will mean that the Fine Gaelers across the country are going to tend to be ahead on the first count of the Fianna Fáilers. And if the gap is... And it's one poll, Gary. It's one snapshot. We don't know how if it will persist. We can have opinions, but it's 6%. 6% will mean that those Fianna Fáilers, many of those Fianna Fáilers, are going to eventually be the men that vote, whose transfers elect the Fine Gaelers. And you may end up having a situation where Fine Gael actually have rather a better election than expected, and Fianna Fáil a far worse one. And I think there are two possible explanations for what's going on here. And this is doing something which the listeners will know Gary doesn't like, because we're just speculating on the basis of raw numbers here, and it's just one opinion, but to hell with it. Not going to say anything particularly new. Micheál Martin has not been speaking for some time. You could argue for the whole of his leadership, but certainly for some time, has not been speaking to the values and the concerns of traditional Fianna Fáil voters. He's relied on that market being safe and solid. And there may have been a reason for him to be confident in that. Where were they going to go? The core vote was there. Do you think now, Gary, one of the problems is that we now have got something rather different. Whether it's AIM2, or whether it's the Independent Ireland, or whether it's just a plethora of independents generally, there are people who are going to be voting in county council elections and Europeans, and they will have candidates in front of them who speak and look and behave more Fianna Fáil-like in their genetic memory, if you like, than the Fianna Fáilers do. They actually will have a real alternative in a way that perhaps they didn't in the past.
Independents, if they continue, they're currently polling at 19%.
Yeah.
They have another poll where they go up 2. They would be, if they were one collective, the second largest party in the country. We know from polling, people who go for independents tend to be more conservative. They tend to be kind of small C conservative, but they tend to be what traditionally would have been considered more to the right, oftentimes not on fiscal affairs, actually, but often on social and cultural affairs. The fact that the independents are still split up is a great blessing and comfort, I think, to the other parties.
Yes.
And I think the problem they have there is that there's no one figure in the independents who's capable of uniting them into one. There are proto-parties starting to form.
Yeah.
There are things going on, obviously. But it's difficult to see whether or not that's, you know, these will live or die, or if they'll die but give birth to something else, and that thing will be the thing that brings these people together. Or whether or not, you know, they'll die and nothing will come in their place and the independents will remain disparate. I think what you're seeing as the independents go up in numbers and as the issues that they care about become more and more, should we say, poorly handled, you may actually start seeing them coalesce into something. And stuff like you're seeing with some of the independents where they're starting to gather councillors together to them. Now, that's not unusual. Independent councillors usually, or independent TDs usually have councillors beneath them who are aligned with them. But you're starting to see it in numbers that you didn't see traditionally.
You're seeing it on a grander scale, and you're seeing it in a more organised and explicit fashion.
Yeah, so I think if I was Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin, I would be concerned that what is happening is basically the organic growth of kind of power blocks in the independents that will start to centralize things into themselves and then might centralize into one person. I don't think there's any person currently on the Irish political scene who has the cachet or the charisma to do that. But, you know, oftentimes come at the hour, come at the man. And that would be disastrous. An independent group that was able to position itself there politically, a disastrous for, I mean, everyone else, and was competent, would be incredibly difficult to deal with, particularly for Fianna Fáil.
Well, yes, because I think a lot of the Fianna Fáil right now, if you talk to, shall we say, more traditional Fianna Fáilers, there is a sense that it doesn't have a story. It doesn't have a narrative. There isn't a strong sense of an identity. It's really relying on just this, I wouldn't say, not cadaver is unkind, but this remnant of the historic core vote. And they're voting because this is still part of their identity. Because, look, I suppose the question is, if Fianna Fáil has moved, and I think that it's reasonable to say that Fianna Fáil has moved under Micheál Martin in its tone, and its values. The question is, okay, if you lose votes because you do that, well, you have to do that with the expectation that you can get votes somewhere else. And it's not clear to me where Fianna Fáil is going to get those new votes from.
No, I think the reason I would say that something like that coming down the line is particularly dangerous to Fianna Fáil, when you could say, well, Sinn Féin would have a problem with it, Fine Gael would have a problem with it. I think it's different for Fianna Fáil because Fianna Fáil is now so weak, but also a party that came together like that and was sort of an organic outgrowth of people like that would look to people who had been in, you know, Michael, the older Fianna Fáil.
Yes.
A lot like what they had come from.
Exactly.
And that might have a moment of, why aren't we that anymore?
Yes.
You start losing people, you start losing councillors to something like that. I mean, it is not beyond the realms of possibility that Fianna Fáil would just bleed to death.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that this is something that will happen over the space of one election. A lot of people were saying to me back in 2011 that this was the end of Fianna Fáil. Fianna Fáil was gone. It was dead. And I disagreed then. Mm-hmm. I said no. 17.5%, they still managed to get 17.5% of the people to come out and vote for them. There's still Fianna Fáil voters out there who are waiting in the wings. When the party has done penance, they will come back. They are still going to be a serious presence. The fact is that Martin has not restored the party. They're 3.5% lower than they were in 2011. He has not restored, he hasn't brought the old Fianna Fáilers back. And having failed to do that, he hasn't gone out and got to other new replacement voters in. And therefore, yes, I can see that having at this stage, I don't see there's any reason to believe that policy is suddenly going to start gaining traction. That for no particular reason, ex-Labour voters, ex-Social Democrat voters, some people maybe from Sinn Féin switching back. I have no reason to see that actually is going to happen. But I can see that core vote just a treat and gradually just flaking away and flaking away. Also because right now, I don't know the most recent numbers we have, but the last numbers I saw suggest that the demographics of the Fianna Fáil core vote is that they are older voters.
Which is good in one way. Those people tend to vote.
It's good in the short term, but in the medium term, Gary, Anno Domini does have an effect.
Yeah, you do need a constant stream of young people to start becoming old people who vote.
Yes.
On the matter of the Irish Times poll, there was one particular thing I noted in it, which is not directly related to governance, but I think is going to have an impact on it. They asked people, do you feel you have more, less, or the same amount of money compared to last year? So disposable income, money in your pocket. If you look at 2020, the last election, 77% of people said they had the same amount of money or more money than the year before.
Yeah.
Only 23% said that it was less. When you look at this towards 2023 and 2024, in 2023, 68% of people said they had less money. Only 11% said they had more. In 2024 so far, 60% of people say they've less money. Only 12% say that they have more. that's a problem for an incumbent government, particularly because, Michael, our taxes are quite high.
It's a massive problem. I mean, you look at 2023 number, you're talking about three times as many people. Three times as many people felt that they had less disposable income in their pockets than they'd had in the year of the previous general election. Not 68%, that was it. Now it's 68, it's gone down to only 60%. 60% of people feel they have less disposable income. Now, if we, now that's, it's not the same question, but if we were then to ask them, well, what, I think it would be very interesting to know what they feel that is going to be in the future. Do they think that that is going to increase, or is it going to stay the same? Because if they feel that it's, this is more or less where they are, that's a real problem, because people vote both on the present and on the future rather than on the past. Is the country going in the right direction is the famous question they always ask in the American polling, and that's very, very often the one of the two most important questions for polling in the United States. So if people feel that this is where we are, and the general sense you got from this, the Irish Times poll, is that there is a lot of anxiety there. A lot of anxiety about the future.
Yeah, I mean, you do see a lot of people saying that they are spending less on non-essentials, you know, using non-branded or kind of, you know, generic branded products. The one I always find interesting is the amount of people who are trying to use less gas or electricity.
Yeah.
In the home, because that very easily verges into, like, you are now under significant pressure. Obviously, not everyone who says yes to that is. But those are the kind of, at that point, you're starting to cut into things that most people would think are necessities.
Yeah. Was it 71% using less fuel, such as gas or electricity, in my home? That's about being comfortable. And that also displays that there are very large numbers of people who are acutely conscious of doing things in a way that perhaps they have not been used to in for a while.
There was also a quite interesting one in relation to the environment. 6 or 4 years ago, Michael, when they asked people if they agreed with the statement, "I am extremely concerned about environmental issues."
Yeah.
68% of people said yes. And I think we were discussing this, maybe not this particular one, but these kind of answers where massive amounts of people say they're extremely concerned. I think we took the line that these people will be concerned until exactly the point where it starts impacting on them financially.
Yeah.
Because the moves that are being talked about to deal with these issues are going to be so expensive that they have to lower your standard of living. And many of them are designed to lower your standard of living. So 4 years, that's gone from 68% to 46%.
I mean, 46% is still a good chunky number, but it's a very significant decline.
We are told, Michael, endlessly, that this is the issue of our times, that it is an existential issue. Now, whatever one thinks about that, either what is happening or the positioning that's put upon it by the media, that is what people are told on a daily basis. So I think people moving on that is actually quite interesting, because it goes against so much of what people are being told. I mean, constantly there are endless grants and things of that nature to talk about the environment, to talk about environmental issues, to talk about how they link to every single facet of human life. And still, the number has gone down by a third.
Yeah, at the same time, as I would say that the reportage in the media and the messages coming from government, both national level and European level, has really ratcheted up the rhetoric. It's no longer a climate concern. It is a climate crisis. It is now, I think actually the term now is climate emergency. And that's what we've been hearing much more strongly for the last 4 years. And yet, even with that narrative, that music playing in the background, we've seen this drop happening. And that is curious.
Mm. There's also some interesting stuff in relation to migrants. They were asking If people agreed with the statement, I worry that Ireland is losing its sense of identity because of the influx of foreign nationals. Now, I've got to say, actually, I hadn't seen the results from 2020 before, but they're actually higher than I thought they would be. 41% of people in 2020 agreed with that, and 40% disagreed with it. Now we're up to 46% agreeing with it, and 33% disagreeing.
I was surprised. I was surprised at the numbers. I was surprised that the numbers who agreed were as high. And I was when 33% disagree, I was surprised that that number was as low as it is. I thought that there would have been an increase in the number who did feel there was a loss of identity happening, because, well, the numbers of people coming to the country has ramped up, and also because the issue has become more present. The problems with housing, the problems with the asylum system have become amplified and become more discussed. 33%, that did surprise me. And in the same context, well, maybe a similar context politically, one interesting thing I noticed in the polling regarding concern about the rise of the far right.
That was quite interesting, actually, particularly the age breakdown.
Yes.
Now, they don't give a sex breakdown, which I would really like to see.
Yeah.
But the amount of people who agreed with the idea, the statement, I worry about the rise of the far right, in total, 30% strongly agreed with it, and another 32% agreed with it. And then, I mean, the amount of people who disagreed strongly, that was probably about 10%, I think, overall. But then when you break it down by age,
it's dramatic.
The 16 to 24 demographic, only 22% agree strongly that they're worried about the rise of the far right. Whereas when you go to 65 plus, it's 43%.
Yeah, it's really interesting. If you look at combining the numbers for agree and strongly agree, in the 16 to 24 bracket, you have a total number of 50% either agree or strongly agree that they worry about the rise of the far right. If you look at the over 65s, that goes up to 77%. And it's honest, if you look at that number for strongly agree, from 16, 24, 25, 34, up to 55, 64, it's 22, 28, 29, 26, 29. So you're in the 20s. Then you hit 65 plus and it goes up to 43%. I'm just throwing it out there. I don't know. We're not in a position to go individually and ask each of the respondents what was the reason. But I do wonder if that is possibly connected to the fact that people who are 65 and over are going to be the people who predominantly will gain their news from RTE and from the newspapers. But this way, Gary, historically you would expect younger people to be more liberal, more progressive, and more left-wing.
Mm.
And if you're going on a predictive, that would normally mean that they would be the people who are more sensitive or more sensible to the problems of a far-right politics. And yet, that's not the case. The youngest cohort are the least concerned. Now, that's not to say they're not concerned, because 50% of them either agree or strongly disagree. 37%, which is, again, the largest number, that neither agree nor disagree, are in the 16 to 24 bracket. Whatever the reason is, it is interesting and it's curious. And I'd be very interested to see what the gender breakdown there was.
These questions are always quite interesting in that, what does disagree strongly mean to someone?
Yeah.
Is it just, I don't think that's an issue at all? Or is it, it's not a problem because I agree with them to some extent or in some form?
Well, do you think that somebody might have seen, I worry about the rise of the far right, and I agree strongly because I worry that there isn't a far right and it's not growing, it's not rising fast enough. I don't think so.
I don't think a substantial amount of people, that is a legitimate concern with survey question design, though. The age ranges that disagreed most strongly, that they with the idea that they were worrying about the rise of the far right, was the 25 to 34-year-olds. 7% of them disagreed strongly, and 7% disagreed, so 14 overall. And in the 45 to 54-year-olds, 13% disagreed strongly.
Yeah.
With another 6% disagreeing, so 19% in total. That's one of those questions I'd quite like to know why people chose what they were voting for and what they think they're being asked.
Mm.
What do they conceive of when they're asked about the rise of the far right? What does it mean to them?
Also, again, when they express a worry, are they worried about a rise in the far right that they are observing? Or are they worried that the conditions that exist might give rise to the rise of the far right?
Mm. Yeah. Then we also have 64% of people saying that they felt over the next year the global economy is going to be worse.
Yeah.
Only 11% thought things were going to get better. I suspect it means something, but I don't know what it means. Is where they asked people, do you agree with this statement? Life has never been more hectic. I feel tired all of the time.
Yeah.
In 2019, 29% of people agreed with that, and 47% disagreed. In 2024, 49% of people agreed with it, and 27% disagreed with it. And when you look at it, it's a pretty clear trend going up, to the extent that next year, you would expect if this trend continues, the majority of the people in the country to say that life has never been more hectic and they feel tired all the time. I don't know what that means politically.
That kind of question, I always wonder, you know, of course, it may simply be the fact or the truth of the people who are, this is what they feel. I do wonder if there are maybe historical or cultural moments where people have an expectation of how they should answer, of how they should feel, that this is the way I'm supposed to feel, so this is how I do feel. I remember talking to a Danish sociologist once, and we're talking about the fact that I think Denmark is one of those countries that regularly scores very highly on those happiness surveys. And I said I'd met a few Danes, and they'd struck me as very nice people, but they hadn't struck me as particularly unusually joyful. And he said that you have to understand that Danes feel that they have a responsibility to be happy. And if you ask them, are they happy, they feel that they should say, yes, yes, I am happy. That it's part of Danish culture that they should be happy. And therefore that different societies may have different expectations. Other places, that if you actually were to go through some kind of a more, I don't know what it would look like, but a more empirical list of things that would, about their lives, that would, generally speaking, give an indication of contentment or lack of contentment, satisfaction or dissatisfaction with life. Other places are more comfortable or are more used to complaining, that this is part of what they do, but it's a more superficial kind of thing. So there may be a cultural thing happening in this kind of question, but It does mean something. Whatever it means, it means something. Not that many years ago, 29% of people believed their life had never been more hectic. It's now 49% of people. That's a very significant rise over the space of 5 years.
We have a situation where people feel like they have less money. They are more concerned with changes in the country. They're cutting down on non-essentials. They appear to be growing increasingly fatigued. And usually, like, when people say they're fatigued, they mean their general mental state is negative.
Yeah.
Partially because it's just really hard to be positive when you're fatigued. So people seem to just be worse off financially, culturally, and personally. Which is not great if you're going into an election and you're the long-term government. I know from polls we've seen and from talking to people who are doing polling, a lot of voters just seem generally pissed off. They're just pissed off.
Mm.
They're just not happy. They're not happy with anyone. And I don't think anyone has quite worked out yet, what do those voters do? Do they swing to one party or the other? Do they not vote? Do they just vote independent? Do they go Sinn Féin? What do they do? But there seems to just be a mass of people who are just done. They're just unhappy with what's happening. And you get the right kind of moment before a vote where someone gets a bit of a wind or starts to become seen as a candidate or a party that can represent that kind of discontent.
Yeah.
It wouldn't take a lot for someone like that, a person or a party, to do very, very well. Now, yeah, that's kind of a lightning in a bottle situation. You can do things to cause that to happen, but most of what you would need is, you know, the government to be inept, which, I mean, up to this point, they have been, you know, in that position.
Also, there was an interesting aspect regarding that sense of economic well-being. There was a curious thing which said that the report suggests that many Irish people feel, quote, they feel strangely sheltered from the full extent of global chaos. There's a sense that we are walking on a tightrope with an underlying fragility to it all. When asked if they felt the global economy would be better or worse over the next 12 months, one in four said it would be the same. 64% suggested things could be worse. That's also, again, not for a government looking to be re-elected, a sense that we are being sheltered. That suggests possibly that this whole, that, okay, we're doing well now. The economy is doing well. Tax receipts, full employment and all that. But it could all change. It could all go horribly wrong.
Yeah, but that could go well for the government as well, because if people feel they're being protected from something that's worse,
yeah,
then they might rally behind you. And you could start seeing that with some of the things like the McEntee getting a bomb threat to her house there the other night.
Yeah.
Stuff like that may cause people to move towards Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, the Greens, people they know, because that's just a sort of anarchy that they're not in favour of.
Yeah, I think that if you look back to the 2007 election, one of the things that Fianna Fáil kept as part of their story was, listen, lads, bad times are coming. We're looking for the soft landing, but whether it's a soft landing or a hard landing, we are not going to go on like this forever. Things are going to change. And Fine Gael have been doing very, very well, but that message seemed to catch in the last week or so, particularly after the debate where Ahern, who's not a great debater, came off better. But there was a sense, if you talk to people within the parties, that there was a real change in the last week where people went for safety, they went for security, that they had a greater sense that, okay, you know, they may have been radically wrong about that. I don't know. That's a whole other question. But they did actually, in the end, swing back to Fianna Fáil on the basis that they knew them and they thought that they would be better positioned to manage the downturn than Fine Gael would be. So, yeah, it could be. It could be that, what's that phrase from Chesterton? Keep hold of nurse for fear of something worse. If bad times are coming, you want the stolid and the safe and the predictable rather than the flashy and the creative and the different who might bring chaos. And when things are going badly, you don't want chaos.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the analysis of the 2020 American election, that a certain amount of people did not vote for Trump and voted for Biden on the basis that they were just tired. It had all been a lot. And they just wanted a president who, you know, might fall asleep at a podium, as opposed to whatever would happen when Trump was there.
Yeah.
Because Trump was unpredictable. Now, unpredictability, as I think we've seen in the Middle East recently, can sometimes be an asset, but that is a different. They also asked, and this is a question I particularly dislike, Do you agree with this phrase? There is equality between men and women in Ireland. Now, I disagree, or I dislike those kind of questions for two reasons. One is, Michael, as you know, you and all the listeners know, that true equality can only be found in the grave.
Okay.
And is on that point certain, so we don't need to worry about that. But it's one of those things where when you start asking people for more kind of conceptual kind of understandings, it can be quite difficult for people to actually figure out what they are answering. And it's very easy to, if you are the researcher, and I'm not saying this happened in this case, but it's more of a general point on survey design, to assume people are saying something that they don't mean to say because they read it in a way that you don't intend. And when you start going to large scale surveying, it's very easy to do that. Now, it has, you know, it's exactly what you expect. More men than women agree there is equality between men and women in Ireland. That's, and actually about twice as many.
If you're doing this kind of surveying, I mean, is what you're saying that you'll be better off asking specific questions, like, for example, do you think that there is equality of employment? Do you think there's equality in education or something? A specific question or a specific issue, rather than asking a more generalized, conceptualized question? Or are you thinking about something even more detailed and more particular than that?
No, I think maybe not that those exact questions, but yes, rather than asking people where they stand on the kind of overarching concept, I think you should break it down, give it more questions, and ask for specific personal experiences,
yeah,
which you can then extrapolate from. It depends what you want to measure, I suppose. If you just want to measure people's perception of it, then there's value in
if you want to measure sentiment.
If you want to actually try and get a gauge on, is there equality between men and women in some particular way, then this wouldn't be the way to do it. But I suppose there's a question of what you want to know. Do you just want to get what people think about it? Well, then, yeah, you know, this is fine. You're going to have those issues, but it's about the best you're going to do with it.
And it's interesting to know just also what people think. And then maybe you could construct other more empirical-based research to see if what they think is actually matched up with the reality. And they're always an interesting thing to see, the difference between what people think and what people actually experience in their lives.
I mean, probably the, just as an example of that, I think the one we brought up the most is the perception amongst women of the primary victims of crime and the likelihood of victimization.
Well, yes. I suppose the vast majority of criminals are men, and the large majority of the victims of crime, I think, are men. Is that right?
That is true. Women dramatically overstate the likelihood that they will be the victim of crime, and particular types of crime most notably. And the problem there is that some of that might reflect different temperaments, different physical capabilities, but I think some of it reflects basically media presentation of the risks. And the problem there, of course, is that if your perception of the risks are skewed one way or the other, you're going to end up engaging in behavior that is negative. So if you think crime is less likely, you might engage in behavior that's overly risky.
Yeah.
And if you think crime is more likely than it is, particularly if you think it's substantially more likely than it is, you might not do things that would be an addition to your life and where there is actually very little risk because you think there is much more risk. And I think that's largely media presentation. Men also can overestimate general crime levels, but women are way off, particularly.
Well, I'm sure we've adverted this before, but this is the one of the central ideas that Jonathan Haidt has talked about a lot when it comes in his book, The Coddling of the American... I think it's The Coddling of the American Mind, when he talks about the changes in the behaviours that are... the way that children were parented, when he says that you had two things came together at the same time and created a very negative outcome, which was you had the advent of rolling news for the first time, so you had 24-hour news. And the thing about anybody who's worked in a news organization knows that when you have 24-hour news, you need to fill it up with news. And at the same time that that happened, there were a couple of high, what became very high profile cases of child abduction. And this created a real heightened sense of danger amongst parents towards children, and the idea that strangers would represent a serious danger to their children. And so, for example, you started to see the idea of a child being sent down two blocks to pick up the papers or to go down on Sunday morning to get the bagels. That kind of thing disappeared. Children walking to school, children going on public transport. So children lost an awful lot of their unsupervised free play, and their lives became far and far more supervised. And Haidt would argue that this has had a very negative impact on the psychological resilience and well-being of American children. And it also massively overstated, and in actually overstated and misstated, the risk to children. Because as we all know, very sadly and unfortunately, if a child is going to be harmed, they are far, far more likely to be harmed by somebody they know than a total stranger. But it all became about stranger danger and don't trust a stranger and all that.
There's also other things, like men tend to have, they tend to be stronger. They also tend to be, this is as, you know, a generality, less neurotic temperamentally. The funny, you would think that would be a positive, Michael, but there was a survey carried out by YouGov a couple of years ago where they asked people, what animal could you beat in a fight?
Sorry, go on.
Yeah. 9% of men thought that they could beat an elephant in a fist fight. So you're like, in general, day-to-day usage, being less neurotic might make things a little bit easier for you, but you may find yourself trying to outbox an elephant.
I remember having a conversation in Dotney's in Dublin. I think it may have been that poll or a poll of a similar nature. And there were a number of strong, fit, capable young men who had a very high regard for their own ability to defend themselves and handle themselves, shall we say. And a couple of them got into a quite detailed analysis of how they would deal with a bear. And the thing is, Gary, well, I think you understand the capacities of a bear, even quite a small bear, shall we say. And all I could say to them was to point out to them that a fairly regular matchup in the arena in Rome when they were putting on these animal fights would be to put a lion up against a bear. And you know who won, Gary?
Generally bears.
Oh, the bears won every time. And my opinion is, if you can beat a lion, you can beat somebody who plays number six for Belvedere or for BlackRock. You know, even a fit man from Terenure is going to struggle where if a lion struggles. But there were a couple of them, and they were, no. So what you'd do is you'd move this, and you'd get a stone, you get stoned, you'd throw it at them. For a start, the bear running on a flat or even on a flat surface can run so much faster than you. And the power, lads, a chimpanzee would rip your head off.
Would you like to know the animal which there was the biggest sex-based difference in confidence that you could beat it in a fight?
Go on, please.
A goose. 51% of women, American women, said that they thought they could beat a goose in an unarmed fight, but 71% of men thought they could take a goose.
So 29% of American men did not believe they could take a goose.
I mean, Michael, I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but the internet is full of pro-goose propaganda.
There is a strong goose body out there, you know. Goose pride.
Yeah, you can't, you know, but click on a website to be reminded that a goose can break a man's arm with its wing.
I thought it was a swan. But
yeah, so, you know, suicidal overconfidence is oftentimes not an issue. But when it is an issue, it's a real issue.
Yeah. 9%. No.
9% thought that they could take an elephant. 7% of men thought they could take an elephant or a grizzly bear. But so did 6% of women.
That's a worry.
Which I just assume is because they've never seen a grizzly bear.
I don't know. That, I mean, I have to believe that actually that must be either a mixture of trolling or shitposting or whatever, because nobody could genuinely believe that they're going to come off best with an elephant or indeed a grizzly bear.
I'm sure someone does believe it.
Yeah. I don't know why. I'm reminded of the old joke. You know, they used to say that if you were trying to get away from a polar bear, you should take off your clothes and leave them behind you, and that the bear would get distracted by the scent of your clothes and stop. And other than the fact that you're now in the Arctic and you're naked, which does not seem to be a very good survival tactic to me, as one man in the business of a zoologist said to me, it's like the old joke. What the only thing that happens there is that when the polar bear catches you, he says, "Oh, lovely, an unwrapped one."
Yes, I think if you're being chased by bears, the thing to remember is that you don't need to be faster than the bear. You just need to be faster than the slowest of your companions.
You have to hope you're with people.
People you're willing to sacrifice to a bear.
Did you ever see that documentary? I think that Werner Herzog documentary about the guy that went to Alaska to live with the bears.
Oh, the guy with absolutely no survival know-how or training who decided to just get a book of plants and try his luck. And that ended exactly how you would think it would end.
Well, the thing is, Gary, the survival stuff, that wasn't really the problem. If you'd taken the bears out of the equation, he would have got on pretty okay.
Actually, I don't think the bears killed him in the end. I think he got poisoned.
No.
Died of dehydration.
No, the bear ate him and he ate him while being recorded.
This is a strange question, but has this happened twice?
Oh, well, it may have happened. I mean, people go to Alaska and go to the wilds of Canada and places like that to get away from it all on a fairly regular basis. But in this particular case, it was actually recorded, and Herzog made it, I think, very decent is not to play it, but he had listened to it and said that it was, shall we say, beyond upsetting. No. He did not die of dehydration. Exsanguination, possibly, but no, not dehydration.
Well, it's a mercy he didn't have to die of dehydration. Took the easy way out. Desanguination by bear.
Anyway, next Sunday is the Sunday, I believe, of the bank holiday. So we shall probably be on a different day. I don't know.
On the Monday.
But anyway, on that basis, have a lovely week and a fine weekend. And we shall be back when we are back.
All the best.